Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN. Presented by the Windjammer Restaurant and Upper Deck Pub. Local, fresh, and Burlington's original steak and seafood restaurant. Now, here's your host, Brady Farkas.
What's up, everybody? Brady Farkas, Champlain Valley Game Night, right here on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. Full show today going all the way up until 7 o'clock. Then we will have NBA action at 7:30 between the Sixers and the Cavaliers. So LeBron against Trust the Process. So will be a good game in the Eastern Conference. So stick with us all the way through until 7, and then basketball tonight. We'll have Bruins hockey over on 960 The Zone. They're taking on the Pittsburgh Penguins. Patrice Bergeron out of the lineup a minimum of 10 days, 2 weeks. He'll be reevaluated, so we'll have that game over on our sister station, 960 The Zone. We had a great time at trivia last night. Thanks to everybody who came out to City Sports Grill in Colchester. I hosted. It was a great time. Arnie was there. Rich was there. Rich tried to sneak on a team of our fellow coworkers and tried to dish them all the answers so that they would win prizes, but we snuffed that out, so we had a good, honest trivia last night as well. Breaking news. Well, not so much breaking anymore, but interesting news and news that you should be aware of. Tomorrow, we will be broadcasting both the Huddle and Champlain Valley Game Night live from Memorial Hall at Plattsburgh State. We'll get ready for the Cardinals in the Division III NCAA men's basketball tournament. They're taking on Nicholls College at 7:30. So here's what happens. And if you've never been to a college basketball Division III NCAA tournament, there's 64 teams in the exact same way that there's 64 teams in March Madness on the Division I side. But rather than seed it, 1 through 64, or 1 through 16, and 1 through 16, and 1 through 16, they don't do that. What they do is they put, there's 16 host sites, and each site holds four teams. So there will be two games tomorrow at Plattsburgh. College of New Jersey will take on Union at 5:30 p.m., and then Plattsburgh will take on Nicholls at 7:30. So if you're going, so it's going to be a big crowd tomorrow. You're going to have a number of people representing the first game, fans, parents there to watch, alumni, coaches, or school administrators, they'll all be there for the first game. And then you'll have a number of people file in for the Plattsburgh game at 7:30. Be a good amount of crossover for the first game between people trying to get seats for the Plattsburgh game. So we're trying to make it like a college game day type experience. 4 o'clock, we'll be there. 4 till 6 for the Huddle, 6 to 7 for Champlain Valley Game Night. We will have we will be there. We will be part of the party. We'll be part of the atmosphere. It is a fun time. I did this at Oswego. Lakers made two NCAA tournaments while I was there. It's a ton of fun. The Division III tournament, there's nothing like it. No, it doesn't have the cachet of Division I, but for these small towns, these smaller communities that don't have those major Division I powers, this is great. This is absolutely huge. We worked really hard to be able to make this happen. There was actually a lot to go through with the NCAA to get this broadcast on site, so we appreciate all the people who helped, and we will be there. And if you're going, get in on the Town Fair Tire text line. Let us know, 802-655-6672. Also, my dad is going to be here in like 25 minutes. He's going to end up locked out of the building for a while because he was supposed to be here at like, he's supposed to be here at like 5:50, and then when the show ended at 6, Rich and Arnie were going to leave, and they were going to open the door for him, and that was going to be that. Well, now he's like, he just texted me, I'm going to be there at 6:30. Well, I'm like, Dad, I'm on the air until then, so you're going to have to enjoy the view of the parking lot for a while until a commercial break when I can come and let you in. So the plan, so here's what's happening. So Dad and I and Jessica, we're going to Ken's Pizza Pub tonight, and we will go there after the show, one of my favorite places to go downtown, in addition to a lot of places downtown. Then tomorrow, I'm going to drag him out to Plattsburgh, and he's going to see the show there and watch the game. And then Saturday, Sunday, everything's up for grabs. No plans yet for Saturday, Sunday. Where should I be taking him? Because I've got ideas. We're going to a brewery. We're going to play tennis indoors at the Edge. Don't call and say, you want to play tennis at the Edge? Because I have to call and make my reservation. We're doing all that stuff. We're doing a brewery. We're going to go downtown again on Saturday or Sunday. Skiing Monday for him, not for me. I got to work, and I don't know how to ski. I value my legs, so although I would like to learn how to ski, I think it would be fun. I already love living here. it would make it exponentially more fun if I knew how to ski. However, it would also be exponentially more expensive if I knew how to ski. So maybe it's better that I don't. So if you have an idea for what I should do with my dad, where I should take him downtown or where I should take him around, 802-655-6672. As for what's coming up on the show today, the Red Sox shed some more light on why they fired John Farrell. That's in about 5 minutes from now. It's championship week, not just for Plattsburgh, not just for UVM, but for other local teams as well. Damian DeJulian, the head coach of St. Mike's men's hockey, they're playing for a conference championship and a de facto Division II national championship. He'll join us at 6:20. And then right after that, Dave Bromirsky, he's an assistant coach at Southern Vermont. Southern Vermont, if you are a Southern Vermont alum and you're in the area, let us know also, because we know you're in the NCAA tournament on the men's side. Dave Bromirsky will talk about their matchup with Wesleyan, and also he played at Plattsburgh State, so we'll get his takes on Plattsburgh as well. Why Odell Beckham Jr. better have the year of his life this year in more ways than one. But first, the Patriots have some tough decisions coming up. And the Patriots are starting to get old. And I know some people will think, well, Brady, the Patriots have been old for a while and they've remained good. They have some critical decisions coming up that will be critical in how their future goes. And what I mean is this. We hear the story today that Danny Amendola has suitors on the free agent market. Some people that will pay him $3 to $5 million a year. And should the Patriots do that? And I think we all agree we love for the Patriots to have Amendola at the right price. If he gets too expensive, then I personally think he ceases to be a must-have re-sign. I don't think they need to go $5 million a year because there's glaring holes in the defensive backfield, and you're going to lose Malcolm Butler, and there's holes on the pass rush and holes at the offensive line position. You're probably going to lose 1 to 2 running backs in free agency. You might cut Mike Gillisley. So you have other needs. I don't know that you need to pay a mid-30s wide receiver $5 million a year. But nonetheless, the Patriots are getting old. You have a 41-year-old quarterback in Tom Brady next year. Julian Edelman's going to be 32 next season. Amendola, if he's back, is going to play part of the year at 33. Gronk's going to be 29. Some of your offensive line is going to hit 30 next year. Devin McCourty and Patrick Chung will both be 31, and they're the leaders of your defensive backfield in the back end. The football is a young man's league right now. It's youthful exuberance. It's energy. You do need that veteran presence. You need a veteran quarterback. You need a veteran at linebacker. And you need an elite pass rusher. But other than that, for the most part, a lot of the guys we talk about as being impact players, they're all young. And the Patriots aren't young. And if they bring back Amendola, and if they bring back Edelman, which they will, and Edelman should come back at 32 and coming off the knee surgery and his relationship with Brady, he should get the chance to. I'm not saying get rid of all these guys. I'm just saying be aware. You can't keep the band together forever. Tom Brady is excellent, and he's going to be around as long as you want, and as long as he wants, and that's fine as long as he's playing well. But then when we start talking about a pair of 32-year-old receivers in Edelman and Amendola, and Amendola is going to play at 33, and then we're talking about two 31-year-old safeties in Chung and McCourty, and Steven Gostkowski, your kicker, is pushing 34, and I know kickers are different, but I'm just using it as an example. You're starting to get old. And I wouldn't be shocked if the Patriots are one of the oldest teams in the league next year if all these guys are back. If you keep Deion Lewis, which I don't think they will, but if they do, he's going to be 27, 28. That's old in running back terms. Rex Burkhead's going to be 27, 28. That's old in running back terms. So the decisions have to be made. The Patriots, if they bring back Amendola, they are missing out on opportunities to draft younger players. Because look at their wide receiver room if Amendola's back. Edelman, Amendola, Brandon Cooks, Kenny Britt, possibly, Chris Hogan, that's five. Malcolm Mitchell, that's six. And then you've got your own practice squad guys. You're going to have eight guys there already. There's no room to go and draft some more young impact players. There's not. So the Patriots will, if they keep Amendola, they're sacrificing an opportunity to possibly get younger. And that's just a tough position to be in. I'm not saying, again, to get rid of everybody. But the band can't be together forever. This group of success, Matthew Slater, he's old, special teamer. Brandon Bolden, he's getting old, special teamer. This crew can't stay together forever. They've been unbelievably successful. They've won two Super Bowls and almost a third. You're going to have some tough choices. And look, I get it. Because we talk about why the Seahawks dropped off this year. And a lot of people want to say, you know, want to point out, you know, my team's failures. That's fine. You're justified to do that. But let's have the real conversation about why the Seahawks struggled this year. The Seahawks struggled this year because they had tough choices to make, and they probably held on too long. They held on too long to their core. They held on too long to the past. And look, I love, as a fan, you know this about me, I like the romanticism of things. I would have been crushed if the Seahawks had cut Richard Sherman or had cut Earl Thomas or hadn't re-signed Cam Chancellor or had, from a football perspective, let Michael Bennett go. The crew that won the Super Bowl, if they had broke them up, I would have been mad at the front office. I totally get it. And I thought that, look, if they were just healthy, they could win a Super Bowl again. But they weren't healthy. Why? Because they're getting old. Cam Chancellor hurt. Neck. May never play again. Richard Sherman hurt. Achilles tendon. Torn. Out. Earl Thomas banged up. It happens. It happens when you hold on. And it happens when you hold on too long. Cliff Averill, Michael Bennett, same thing. Hurt. Ineffective when they do play. Averill may never play again. That is what happens when you hold the band together. When you hold on to greatness like that, greatness ages. And in the NFL, greatness ages fast. One day, the Seahawks are losing at the goal line on the Malcolm Butler play, and you think, there they are, they'll be back again next year. And they're not. And Marshawn Lynch gets injured. And they slide down a little bit. And then everything I just told you happens. And then there's tension in the locker room. I'm not saying the Patriots are going to become the Seahawks because Bill Belichick operates a lot different than Pete Carroll does. I get it. But when you keep greatness too long and you start to let your team age, and when you're playing so deep into the playoffs every single year and you're aging, you're playing a month longer than everybody else. It's hard. Danny Amendola is one player, but it represents, if they bring him back, they're making a choice to allow themselves to get older. And you love it as a fan, but I'm telling you that if it doesn't work, it looks ugly. At Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. 802-655-6672. We're about 7-8 minutes away from Damian DeJulian, St. Michael's men's hockey coach, and then Dave Bromirsky, Southern Vermont basketball coach, will join us as well. Something I read today on the Red Sox, and it sheds more light onto why John Farrell was fired. So we heard Red Sox management say at the first day of spring training that they did not like the offensive approach of the team last season, and we wondered why. Well, what did the Red Sox do offensively that had the front office so bothered? And now it gets a little more clear today. So Alex Speer of the Boston Globe writes this story that the Red Sox upper management took notice of the approach that the Red Sox were basically working counts too much. And they took an abnormally passive approach at the plate last season. Listen to this. The Red Sox ranked in the bottom third in baseball in hitting in 3-1, 2-0, 2-1, 1-0, 0-0, 1-1, 0-1 counts. In what are supposed to be hitter-friendly counts, the Red Sox were in the bottom third of the league. They ranked last in the American League in batting average, on-base percentage, slugging when the count was 0-0. Take all those counts out of it. What does that tell me? The Red Sox were abnormally passive, as Speer said, and they were not aggressive at the plate early in counts. When I coached college baseball, the first thing that the head coach taught me and that I relayed to the team was jump on fastballs. Jump on fastballs early, because it's cliche. You won't get a better pitch to hit then the pitcher wants to establish the strike zone. The pitcher, we're taught as pitchers to get ahead in the count. You as hitters, to counteract that, need to jump on first pitch. Jump on fastballs in fastball counts. And people say, oh, you got to work the count. You got to work the count. Oh, let's get the starter out of there. That works really well in high school when the bullpen is a major weakness, when the starter's good and you have no idea what's coming after. That works well in college when the kids are 20 and the kids are 18 and they have girl problems and class problems and they're just not as good as the starter. Getting to the bullpen is a big deal. In the major leagues, sure, get the starter out after five. Then what happens? Go to the Yankees bullpen after five. 98, 99, 100, 101, 104. Like, that's what you get in the major leagues. So I have never been a big believer in Major League Baseball in going deep into counts because, sure, you can get the pitcher, you can get the starter out if you rack up the pitch count, but the bullpen guys are just as good, if not better, and they're throwing even harder. And what did we know last year about Alex Cora? Alex Cora's Astros team, they won the World Series. How? Partly because of what they did in counts where you're supposed to be productive. Get this. 0-0 count. The Astros hit 382. 1-0. The Astros hit 307. 2-0. The Astros hit 400. 2-1. The Astros hit 385. 3-1. The Astros hit 396. When you are ahead in the count, and you are ahead in the count in a big way, you are supposed to put up those numbers that the Astros did. The Red Sox got up 2-0 and took a pitch, and yeah, seven-pitch at-bat, it ends in 2-2, 3-2, and that's it. When it's 0-0, hunt for a fastball. When it's 3-1, hunt for a fastball and take your shot at it. That is the approach the Red Sox are hoping to preach this year. It's the approach that worked for Cora and his team last year in Houston, and they ultimately won the World Series. I hope the Red Sox adopt this philosophy this year, because if they do, I think they're going to be far more successful. Glenn Monkton says, the Red Sox have historically always worked the counts. It's not just last year. And Glenn, I've always hated it. Once the relievers started being as dynamic as they are at every reliever through 97, I started hating taking pitches. Because it's no longer to your advantage to get the starter out. Sure, get Clayton Kershaw out. There's Brandon Morrow throwing 98. And then you get him for an inning. And there's Kenley Jansen throwing 95 with one of the best cutters we've seen this side of Rivera. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The relievers are awesome too. So hunt the fastballs early. And you know what? If you get a seven-pitch inning on you, I'll take that. I'd wear that if I were Alex Cora, because if I'm going to hit 382 on 0-0 and 307 on 1-0 and 400 on 2-0 and 385 on 2-1 and nearly 400 on 3-1, the odds are with me that I'm going to have big innings if I'm swinging early in the count. And you know what? If I can score 5 runs in the second by the second inning and 8 runs by the third because I'm doing this, I'm not the starter out anyways. And then maybe I'll get to the fourth inning in the bullpen where I do have a middle reliever that's hittable. If this is the approach the Red Sox take, then I absolutely love their opportunity to do some damage on offense this year and get guys like Betts, like Ramirez, to rebound. Get guys like Martinez to be productive. Get guys like Benintendi to be productive. All right, when we come back, championship weekend, baby, one of my favorite times of the year. Damian DeJulian, head coach, St. Michael's men's hockey, and then we'll talk to Dave Bromirsky, Southern Vermont men's basketball, also used to play on the team over at Plattsburgh State. That's next, Champlain Valley Game Night, 101.3 ESPN.
It's Champlain Valley Game Night with Brady Farkas, only on 101.3 ESPN.
All right, welcome back. Champlain Valley Game Night right here on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. So this is one of my favorite times of the year because it's championship week. We got championship week in high school. We got sectional playoffs in New York. We got playoffs in Vermont. We got hockey. We got basketball. Oh, by the way, baseball spring training is going on. So this is a great time of year. And this segment's going to be really fun because we're going to get a chance to talk to two different sets
of teams in the playoffs. So let's start it right now. Let's go out to the TikTok Jewelers guest line and talk with Damian DeJulian. He's the head men's hockey coach at St. Michael's College. They're playing for the Northeast 10 Championship this weekend at St. Anselm. 3:30 is face-off there. And again, Northeast 10 Championship on the line. Coach DeJulian, thanks for being with us. How are you?
I'm great. How you doing?
Well, good. I appreciate you joining us. First off, explain to our listeners what the heck is going on in Division II hockey, because you guys are playing a championship game, but it's also like the national championship.
Yeah, kind of de facto. The NCAA doesn't recognize a Division II national champion in hockey. There's only six teams, so we do the best we can. We play who we play, and we end up with a championship at the end of the year. And it's it's a lot of fun. The hockey's really, really good, and I think the two best teams are in the final, so it should be great.
Now, how does it work? Well, you say only six teams. I guess what's the reasoning to even have Division II hockey? Why not have those six teams go up to Division I or drop down to Division III or splinter off and do whatever they want? What's the reasoning?
I don't think we have enough time to get into all of it, but safe to say, basically in hockey, there's Division I and Division III, and then there's just a few of us who are stuck around in Division II, and there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes with the NCAA and why they don't do or don't recognize certain things. So again, that's a longer conversation and one I'm happy to have, but you probably don't have time for it right now.
Well, your team 15-9-2. This season as you head into this conference championship game. Big step up from last year. You guys had just 9 wins last season. Why the turnaround this year?
I think a couple reasons. I think obviously we've played better, and we've gotten some great contributions from our senior class all the way down to our freshmen. We've 12 freshmen. My assistant Dan Allen did just a terrific job recruiting and bringing in some really high character players and high quality players. We've just done a nice job playing kind of fearless and bringing it every night, and I couldn't be more happy with the season. It's just been a fun group to coach.
Now, you mentioned some of those seniors. One of your seniors is our own intern, Sam Finkelstein, who was with us this summer, and he's got 15 assists, team-leading 12 assists and a team-leading plus 15 for you guys. Intern Fink, pretty good?
He's had a great year. I couldn't be happier for Sam. It's just been terrific to watch him develop, both on the ice and off the ice, in the classroom and in the community. And really, I could not be happier for the local product, Sam Finkelstein. I've known him since he was probably 6 years old, and so it's fun to watch.
So you got him, who's a local kid. You got a kid from Essex as well. Yep. How important is it for you to hone in the local talent and keep local talent local?
I think it's real important. Anytime we can, we try to recruit Vermonters. Sometimes they want to come play and stay around home, and sometimes, quite frankly, they want to get out of Dodge and try something new and play someplace new, which is respectable as well. But anytime we can recruit a local player, we do. Nate Foyce from Essex has been just terrific for us, and we talked about Sam, and last year we had Caleb Lothian. So we try as best we can to keep the good players home, that's for sure.
Damian DeJulian, he's the head coach, St. Michael's Men's College Hockey, and they're playing for the Northeast 10 Championship this weekend at St. Anselm, Saturday, 3:30. We're here on Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN. We talk about the challenges of being Division II in a Division I and Division III world. Talk to me just, though, about how hard it is to build a schedule like that.
The Anytime's done a great job. When we went to a strictly Division II league this year, it's our first time we've done it. We play each team 3 times. And then we play our non-league schedule, which are all Division III teams. Division III teams are happy to play us. So, we played Middlebury this year. We played Amherst. We played Wesleyan. We played Newman. Very nice of Castleton to play us. We try to play the in-state teams. Some play us, some don't. So we've got a great non-league schedule that challenges us and gets us ready for our league play. So it's been actually kind of fun. Played Potsdam a couple times, and we'll go back and play them again next year. So it's been fun to play our non-league schedule, and pretty fun to develop some new rivalries and play a team 3 times, and you kind of get to know guys pretty well and get to know other student-athletes well. So it's been a fun year schedule-wise.
I'm penciling you in for this championship, by the way. 8-2-2, you are on the road. 6-7 at home, Coach.
Make sure it's in pencil right now.
Yeah, okay? What's up with the 6-7 at home? Why are you so much better on the road?
Well, you know what? I don't think that's totally uncommon in sports. I think sometimes there can be a little more pressure at home. There can be, you know, a few more distractions, be it at school or be it, you know, in the rink. So I think when guys go away, they just kind of play and they forget about everything. And, you know, some of it's just happenstance as well. So, you know, we've been pretty good on the road this year. And so I'm excited to go down to St. A's. It's a beautiful rink. And they are very well coached, a guy I respect very much in the game, Jim Tortorella. So it should be a fun game.
Damian DeJulian, hey, we appreciate the time. We wish your team the best of luck looking for a conference championship and therefore the de facto national championship.
Okay, now you got to promise me when Alabama wins the championship again next year, we're going to talk Alabama football.
You want to talk Alabama football? We're talking.
I always try to get it in there, but nobody ever calls me, you know, after the championship game.
Damian DeJulian, you win, and next year we'll talk Alabama football. How about that? Good luck this weekend.
Thank you very much for having me, and we'll go get them as best we can.
We know you will, Coach, and we're rooting for you. So there he goes. And now I told you, this is going to be a fun segment, a chance to hit a couple of different things. So let's go right back out to the phone lines, talk a little college basketball. And what I am referring to is Southern Vermont College, because we've talked a lot about Plattsburgh, and we're going to be at Plattsburgh tomorrow for the D3 NCAA Hoops Tournament. We've talked a lot about Middlebury and UVM, of course. But Southern Vermont, a lot of alums in this area, also headed to the NCAA tournament at the D3 level. And one of my favorite things to do is to find teams that not only have ties to this area, but also players and coaches that have come through. So on that Southern Vermont College staff is Dave Bromirsky, 10 years now as an assistant coach, but he cut his teeth way back in the day as a member of the Plattsburgh State men's hoops team. So Dave Bromirsky, thanks for being with us. How are you?
Good, good. Very good, Brady.
Well, Dave, congratulations on all the success. Your team will take on Wesleyan tomorrow night. And I got to tell you this first and foremost. Now, you're from a little north of where I am in Albany, but every Friday night, I'll tell you, when I was growing up in high school, same year as me, you had a son, Shea Bromirsky, who seemed like he would score about 1,000 points a game. So every night, I would have to check the online box score to see just how many points your kids scored, Dave.
Yeah, Shea had a great high school and college career at Cambridge, and then moving down the road to St. Rose. He could put the ball in the hoop when he wanted to. It was fun to coach him, and then fun to watch him in college.
You know, I never actually got to play against him because I played at Shenandoah, Class AA school, and Cambridge was far smaller. But I saw him play on the AAU circuit, and I was like, dang, this kid can flat out stroke it. So you taught him well.
Yeah, he was a gym rat, for lack of a better term. I couldn't keep him out of the gym. He was following me around from the time that he was two, three, 4 years old. He was in the gym, and he never said that he didn't want to go. And some days when there was a half a foot of snow, on the ground, and everything else was closed, we were running to the gym because he wanted to get his daily ration of shots up.
Well, in addition to Shea, you also had a son, William, who played basketball at Southern Vermont, and you actually had the chance to coach him. He just graduated a few years ago. You're in your 10th season there. What was it like to coach your kid at the college level?
It was great getting Will to come back here. He was a really big piece of what we were doing that year. We had a bunch of kids come together from lots of different places. And it was a blast coaching them all. But William was interesting to coach. Let's just say he is very opinionated and very narrow minded sometimes. But all he wanted to do was win. And you know, when you've got kids that want to win, it's easy to coach them.
Well, we'll talk about your team now, present day, 22-5, conference champions, and you'll take on Wesleyan out of the NESCAC again on Friday. What makes your team this year so good?
Dan and I were actually just talking about this in the office a second ago. We've been very adaptable. We started out with a bigger roster. The roster got a little skinnier. Beginning of the year, we were playing team defense as well, but by the end of the year, we had a few players buy into what we were trying to do, and defensively, we became a much more effective team. And this year, we were able to run lots of different offensive sets, which was different than last year. We got to play with them on the offensive end. We could put something in almost every game.
you know, the NCAA at the Division III level doesn't seed the tournament in the way we're used to at the Division I level. There is no one official 1 versus 16, but you guys are a small school in Southern Vermont. Wesleyan's in the NESCAC, and we know how good that league is from paying attention to Middlebury. So you guys are going in as the underdog. How do you get your guys believing you can win tomorrow?
It's like playing with house money almost.
Yeah.
Trying to convince them that, you know, that the pressure's off, that we really don't have much to lose because no one outside of this building in this small little college community really thinks we have a chance. We do. We think that we've game planned well for them and scouted them well and prepared the fellas for the game, but getting them with that almost bunker mentality sometimes in situations like this lets them, you know, just go and run the game.
We're talking with Dave Bromerski. He's assistant coach on Southern Vermont men's basketball team in Southern Vermont in the NCAA tournament this weekend out in Wesleyan, out in Connecticut, and we're here on Champlain Valley Game Night. You know, I mentioned this one of my favorite times of the year. It's also one of my favorite things to do, to find people who are successful that have ties to our local listening area, and you certainly do. Back in the 80s, you were a player on the Plattsburgh State men's basketball team. What did that experience at Plattsburgh do for you moving forward as you got your, you know, your adult life going?
One of the biggest lessons that I learned is that sometimes you don't get what you always want, because while I was playing at Plattsburgh, Derek Rowland was playing in Potsdam. And every year you're running into a team, 1 year that didn't lose a game, and then the next year they lost one game.
Yeah.
And they had two NBA pros on the team, and then, you know, a couple other kids that had careers overseas. So, you know, yeah, you have your dreams of wanting to get to the NCAA tournament, but sometimes you gotta find, you know, goals that are, you know, adapt your goals a little bit more reasonably and, you know, try to win big games versus win the biggest games.
As far as Plattsburgh goes itself, do you ever get to come back up to the area? I mean, you're not that far away in Bennington. Do you ever get to come back up to Plattsburgh?
When my kids were on the AAU circuit, we got up there, especially with my daughter Amelia. They seem to always have a tournament up at Seton Catholic out in the old on the old Air Force base, and we would get up there at least once a spring with them. And then Amelia played in the soccer regional up in Plattsburgh, and that got me back up there again. So yeah, I get up to the area, and we spend some time in the Adirondacks every summer. So we're never very far.
I know it's not your program, but as we talked about, Plattsburgh's going to play in the NCAA tournament. How cool is it for you to see your alma mater get that opportunity that you didn't get to be back in the NCAA tournament?
I love the way the program. When I played under Coach Norm, he was, let's just say, a little bit of a slowdown guy.
Yeah.
Very regimented in who shot, when you shot, where you shot from. And I watch it, and yeah, I love how they get up and down the floor. They play a fun brand of basketball, and they're really enjoyable to watch. And it's nice to see them having such success up there.
We'll get you out of here on this. Back in the day, what was the go-to spot for you in Plattsburgh? What was the food place that you couldn't live without back in the day?
Probably Filion's. That was the go-to place.
Well, I'll have to reach out to our text line and see how many people remember that place and frequented it also. Dave Bromerski, Southern Vermont men's basketball assistant coach, 10 years now in NCAA tournament tomorrow. They'll take on Wesleyan. Coach, we're looking forward to it. Best of luck to all of your kids because they've all been successful. We wish you the best and your team the best also.
Thanks, Brady. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it also. There he goes, Dave Bromerski, assistant coach at Southern Vermont. Yeah, his kids were really good. His kid, Shay, the one who I know, played the same age as me, played at St. Rose College, as he told you, and he scored a bunch of points there and played with some of my friends at St. Rose also, and actually helped train my little brother in high school. So a lot of experience there with the Bromerskis. Good thing I didn't play against him, because Shay Bromerski would have made me look like I usually make Arnie look. So that's just about how bad that would have gone, because he could really flat out score. So no surprise that Southern Vermont's good with that kind of coaching and that kind of lineage coming through. All right, reminder, tomorrow broadcasting live on the campus of Plattsburgh State. We'll be out at Memorial Hall. Cardinals getting ready for their own Division III NCAA tournament matchup. We'll be there at 4. We'll go all the way until 7. Tip off for the Cardinals game is 7:30. They're taking on Nichols College. 22-4, 19 games in a row for the Cardinals. They've got the Suniak Coach of the Year. They've got the Suniak Player of the Year. They play above the rim. They play fast. We are really looking forward to it. Remember, UVM, the America East playoffs, they tip off on Saturday night. We've got that coverage for you, 6:30 for the tip-off from Patrick Jim. When we come back, Odell Beckham Jr. has to be on his best behavior this season, and he needs to have the best season he's ever had. That's next, Champlain Valley Game Night, 101.3 ESPN.
It's Champlain Valley Game Night with Brady Farkas, only on 101.3 ESPN.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Champlain Valley Game Night right here on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. Reminder, we go up until 7 o'clock, and then we will have NBA action, 7:30. It is the Sixers at the Cavs, so a couple of the Celtics' biggest rivals going at it in the Eastern Conference. Remember, tomorrow, broadcasting live out at Plattsburgh State from 4 till 7. If you want to get in, 802-655-6672. Dad has made it in the building. I guess if you stand outside long enough, somebody will let you in. So where should we go? Where should I take him this weekend? So Ken's Pizza Pub tonight, hit the downtown scene, Plattsburgh tomorrow for the big remote, maybe McGillicuddy's in Essex at Five Corners. So if you want to come and hang out, I'll make him buy you all drinks. So we'll do that. Over the weekend, First Republic Brewery, I think, is happening. But I need some other things to occupy his time. So where should we go? 802-655-6672. Odell Beckham Jr. not only needs to have a great season this year for the New York Giants to be competitive, to be successful, to have any chance, he needs to have a great season on the field for his own future, and he needs to be on his best behavior for his own future. According to Ian Rappaport of the NFL Network, Odell Beckham Jr. wants $20 million a year in his next contract. Oh, by the way, the record for a wide receiver contract is $17 million a year. Antonio Brown's current deal, 4 years, $68 million. OBJ wants to blow that out of the water. And Odell Beckham Jr. missed nearly all of last season with injury. And I tell you what, Odell Beckham Jr., the Giants could maybe make that kind of deal happen, but you've got to do a whole lot to prove that you're even close to worth as much as you think you are. Right now, this year, the Giants don't have a whole lot of cap space. They can't make a massive deal this year. They can't give him $20 million this season. He's due to make $8 million on his current deal. He's on the fifth year of his rookie deal. He'll make $8 million this year. The Giants could extend him, but they can't give him a whole lot more money than his $8 million. If the Giants are going to give him massive money moving forward, they're going to need to see the best of OBJ on the field. Is he proven that he's recovered fully from that injury, that ruptured, you know, that broken ankle that he had last season? Is he still productive? Can he be part of their rebuild for when they have life without Eli Manning? Is he going to play nice with a rookie quarterback, with a second-year quarterback, whoever it ends up being? Can he be that guy? Can he be the face of your franchise and be on his best behavior? Because Dave Gettleman's MO in his history as a GM has not been to let the players dictate things. Okay, there's a reason why Dave Gettleman in 3 years won a couple of NFC South titles in Carolina and took the Panthers to a 15-1 record and a Super Bowl appearance and then got fired. If you go 15-1 and win a couple of NFC South titles, why are you getting fired? There's something deeper there. And the reason why, Dave Gettleman did not play nice with his players in contract negotiations. Josh Norman's not in Carolina anymore. Why? Dave Gettleman wouldn't pay him what he thought he was worth. Greg Olsen and Thomas Davis wanted, you know, the veteran good guy contract extensions, and Dave Gettleman wouldn't give it to him. And so Panthers management fired Dave Gettleman. Dave Gettleman does not historically play nice with his players. He's told you up front, I'm not going to lie, we're going to do it my way, we're going to do it the old way. He's a tough-as-nails GM, and a lot of you Giant fans have sung his praises because it's the return to the Coughlonian type of thinking. And OBJ is going to want, if OBJ is going to want the money that he wants, Gettleman's not inclined to give it to him. So Beckham is going to need to not only perform at an unbelievably high level this year, he's going to need to be unbelievably well-behaved to, I think, even get in the conversation of getting $20 million a year. I think even to get the Antonio Brown contract, he's going to need to be incredibly productive and incredibly well-behaved. Because Gettleman, he's just not that guy. He's not going to bend and acquiesce to Beckham just because he's a star. He's trying to rebuild a whole organization. And generally, when you're building an organization, you build it from the inside out, baby. You build it from the trenches and the quarterback, and then you move out to the perimeter players. Odell Beckham Jr. wants this big contract to make the Giants about him on the perimeter. We saw how well the perimeter worked for the Giants last year. It didn't work. Of the top 10 highest-paid wide receivers in the NFL last year, only three made the playoffs. The proof is in the pudding that the Giants need to quarterback, offensive line, running back, defensive line, linebackers. That's where this team needs to be built. If Beckham wants to get in the conversation of getting the Antonio Brown money plus some, man, he's going to have to be really, really good. He's going to have to be really, really healthy, and he's going to have to be really, really well-behaved because he's going to have to change 50-something years of the way that Dave Gettleman has looked at football players, and it's not favorably when it comes to player contracts. Champlain Valley Game Night here on 101.3 ESPN, although I do think the Giants could make that deal happen logistically. Once Eli Manning comes off the books, there's a lot of open money there. Now, does Dave Gettleman want to put that all on Odell Beckham Jr.? Again, I doubt it. But if he wants to even get considered for it, he better be really good this season. Again, Sixers and Cavs coming up at 7:30. And I was watching spring training today. I went home for lunch, and I caught a little bit of spring training baseball between the Yankees and Phillies. And I watched CeCe Sabathia pitch. And I tell you what, I have never really loved CeCe Sabathia. I didn't like what he said last year, his comments about, you didn't like the Red Sox bunting on him. Well, that's because he's not in the best of shape and he's got bulky knees. And of course he doesn't like it when you're bunting on it. Toughen up, buttercup, as Arnie always says. I've never loved Sabathia, but I like the way he has reinvented himself because it's really hard. You guys hear me say this a lot. I like self-awareness. It's really hard to recognize who you are now versus who you were then. And CeCe Sabathia used to be 96, 97 with a devastating slider. Now he's 87, 90 with a really good changeup and a cutter. He has willed himself into becoming a pitcher that was way different than the pitcher that he was 10 years ago that won a Cy Young. He has willingly accepted who he is and accepted that transformation. It's the thing that's so hard for me as a Mariners fan to watch Felix Hernandez do because he's unwilling to do that. He thinks he's the king still, and he's not. He thinks he can throw 96-97, and he thinks he can have 12 strikeouts a game. He can't do that, but he doesn't quite see that yet. And that's hard for me as a fan to watch him not be able to recognize what's so easy for me to see. CeCe Sabathia has recognized that, has willingly accepted that, has transformed himself, and as a result, has given himself, a pretty good age 37 and up part of his career that most people don't get. And it's impressive to watch, and I enjoyed watching CC pitch today. All right, that'll do it for us. Thanks to Rick Pigeon, who joined us in the huddle, part of a Daytona 500 winning pit crew with Kurt Busch last year. Thanks to the guys from St. Michael's Men's Hockey and Damian DeJulian, who joined us, Dave Bromirsky, Southern Vermont Basketball. We're broadcasting live tomorrow, Memorial Hall in Plattsburgh. We'll see you there. Division III NCAA Men's Basketball Tournament, Memorial Hall on the campus, SUNY Plattsburgh, 4 o'clock tomorrow. We'll see you there, everybody. It's 101.3 ESPN.